Young Lords are a very, very good example of an organization that was influenced by the Panthers, both in terms of directly where they came from and in terms of trying to take up the same kind of politics to deal with the issues that existed for their people. And organizations like this developed in every racially or nationally oppressed community in the United States. In the Southwest, you have Chicano youth creating organizations like the Brown Berets that attempted to do the same thing. Again, in a remarkably similar situation, of course, you have the Chicano people suffering horrific national oppression for 150 years since the occupation of the Southwest by the United States, and the same kind of politics is taken up. And in the Asian American community, mm-hmm. where many of the issues are similar, but there are also some differences. Incidentally, this is when Asian American is actually coined as a term. It was created
at this time.
It was created mm-hmm. to create political unity between Chinese and Japanese and Filipino Americans, basically, and the other East and South Asian communities that existed in the United States, and to replace the racist term Oriental. But in any case, in New York, Chinese American youth created an organization called Ai Wor Kwen, which was named after a revolutionary nationalist organization in China in the early 20th century, and that, again, tried to take revolutionary politics to the Chinese community, to New York's Chinatown, where people were struggling over housing. Many established Asian communities in the United States were being displaced at this point by urban development. So there was a struggle for people to be able to stay in their homes and for real redevelopment in those communities that wouldn't drive people out but would actually give people jobs and enable people to stay where they were living in a coherent sort of ethnic cultural community where people wanted to live. So that was one of the fronts of struggle for the Asian organizations that took this up. There was another organization of Chinese and Japanese American youth in San Francisco called the Red Guard Party that was, as you can probably tell by its name, also influenced by China, as was Ai Wor Kwen in New York. They were influenced by the Chinese Revolution and the Cultural Revolution going on in China. But they were also very, very immediately influenced by the Black Panthers. And again, it's a very, very similar story in that they took up the demands and the needs of their people in this very, very immediate way, but tried to relate revolutionary politics to those things. And of course, being in San Francisco, they had a very, very close, materially close relationship with the central leadership mm-hmm. of the Black Panther Party mm-hmm. in Oakland. And there was another organization, a Latino organization, which I would call it that because it wasn't just member. They weren't just Puerto Rican. They weren't just Chicano. There were Puerto Ricans and Chicanos and Central American immigrants involved, called the Los Siete organization, and that developed out of a situation where a group of Latino activists, young Latino activists, seven of them, were being framed for the murder of a couple of police officers, and an organization developed that was originally basically just the Los Siete Defense Campaign. But then developed into a wider organization to serve the impoverished and oppressed Latino community in a neighborhood called the Mission District in San Francisco. And they established ties with the Red Guard Party and with the Black Panthers in Oakland. And this was definitely conceived of as internationalism because, again, the ideological framework that these people were adopting at this time, the young activists were adopting at this time, was based on a firm rejection of the idea that their communities were minorities mm-hmm. in American society, that they were American minorities, Mexican Americans or what have you, and based on an understanding of their communities as nations, as colonized, oppressed nations within the United States. It was slightly different with the Asian American communities, who had a somewhat different historical experience in terms of immigration, but in general, they all saw themselves as being intimately connected to the surge of third world national liberation struggles and of having a deep, deep commonality of interest in overturning white supremacist capitalism in the United States. And the American Indian movement also developed in the mm-hmm. at the same time yeah. among initially young Native Americans in the cities in the Midwest, but also spreading across the country. And their ideology was had a different, to some extent, a different set of influences, influenced by sort of a revival of indigenous traditionalism in a lot of ways. But they also did echo the Third World Internationalist ideology of the Black that was being put forward by the Black Panthers and these other organizations to an extent. So again, there are variations dealing with the specific histories and deriving from the specific histories of all of these oppressed people, but ultimately they were united by a common framework that the Panthers had developed and popularized. And that might not seem so remarkable. It is, but it might not seem that way given that all of these groups of people suffer from racial oppression in North American society. But then there was another set of organizations that was influenced by the Black Panther Party that, as you said, many people are surprised to learn ever existed because they were organizations made up of white people. And I've already mentioned one group of white people that was influenced by the Black Panther Party, and that was Students for a Democratic Society. But Students for a Democratic Society had a particular demographics, a particular social character, in that it was made up of university students, and it was made up in the majority of young white people from middle-class backgrounds. Working-class people were going to university in the United States in larger numbers than they ever had before at this time, but at least the founders and the people who set the character of SDS were mostly middle-class people. But towards the end of the 1960s, some young white activists who were from working-class backgrounds began to wonder if they wouldn't be able to organize in their own communities. And this was also a demand that was being put to them by the black movement. Mm-hmm. Not so much specifically by the Black Panther Party, although the Black Panther Party did play a role in it. But one important development that happened in the late 1960s was that the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which had been the main organization of black youth in the United States in the early 1960s, took a nationalist turn. People like Stokely Carmichael became more and more influenced by African nationalism, by Pan-Africanism. And a decision was made that white activists would no longer be allowed to work in the organization. And they were told to go organize their own people. And most of the white activists who were involved, some of them were, you know, they were hurt, but they accepted the political rationale. They accepted, you know, the fact that they needed to take direction from the black movement on this. And they did start to take up the task of organizing their communities. Of course, one of the features of the situation is that the situation in North America in the late 1960s is that there's a real climate of militancy and mass mobilization among people of color, especially the black community, but not just the black community, in all these other oppressed nationality communities that we've been talking about. But there was much less of that going on among the broad majority of white Americans outside of the campus environment. But there was a very significant effort made to change that. And so you have organizations sprouting up in white working class communities in Brooklyn, in Chicago, in Philadelphia, in Boston, in Vancouver. There was an organization in Vancouver that tried to carry out the politics of the Black Panther style sort of community organizing. It was called the Partisan Party. And some of these organizations, it's funny, they had names that you would not imagine a leftist organization having. There was an organization in Brooklyn called White Lightning, which sounds like a racist organization, but it was a militant anti-racist organization that was taking up this task of organizing white people. And that meant two things. That meant attempting to convince poor and working-class white Americans that they should support the black liberation movement. But it also meant organizing these communities around their own needs, and there were particular situations that were sort of very, very close in some ways to the situation that had produced the Black Panther Party. In the 1940s and 50s and 60s, there was a huge migration of poor white people from Appalachia into the industrial sort of Northwest and Great Lakes area, and they ended up concentrated together in communities. With high unemployment and low incomes and terrible housing, and young people in those communities were dealing with police harassment as well. So there was an organization that developed in this this Appalachian community in Chicago called the Young Patriots. Again, Fred Hampton. Fred Hampton was able to create an alliance between the Black Panthers, the Young Patriots, the Young Lords. I believe there may have been a Chinese organization in Chicago involved as well, a Chinese-American organization. And this was called the Rainbow Coalition, which, of course, would be sort of the name 20 or so years later, adopted by the Jesse Jackson campaign in a very, very different set of political circumstances. But this was the first Rainbow Coalition, and it's probably the clearest example of the internal internationalism, you could say, of the Black Panther Party. And I think Fred Hampton expressed this most articulately and most clearly, but it came from all the major leaders of the Black Panther Party, was that they really deeply believed that they were not simply participating in and dealing with a struggle of black people against racist oppression. What they were dealing with was a struggle of all oppressed and colonized nations and all oppressed and exploited people in North America, in the United States, in North America, and in the world against a system defined by racism, but also by capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so they believe that even if at first, you know, many white workers were hesitant or poor white people were hesitant to support the Black Liberation Movement, that ultimately this alliance could be created because all oppressed and exploited people had common interests. And that's also one of the crucial contributions that the Black Panther Party made.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, this is something we are definitely not told about. I mean, the idea that the white supporters of the Black Panther Party, who actually made a real effort,
yeah,
like organizing effort in their own communities to organize, like, effectively white people against the very colonial structure, racist colonial structure,
yeah,
that had, you know, supposedly empowered them, but at the same time, you know, supposedly elevated them over African Americans and, like, indigenous people and this sort of thing, but basically were also using them and exploiting them and basically treating them as, you know, weapons to be used, tools, mm-hmm, you know, basically being used and turning them almost into little monsters, which they effectively were refusing to be a part of, which is pretty profound. I think that has lessons for us right now.
Absolutely.
You know? But thank you very much for coming on and talking to us about this, because, I mean, this is absolutely... This conversation has been amazing.
It's my pleasure.
You know, your insight into this, like, you brought a lot of knowledge here, and I'm amazed you managed to remember all that. I mean, you can't see this. People are actually listening in, but Brendan is sitting here. He has no notes in front of him. He's basically just, you know, you did a lot of preparation, obviously.
I tried.
But at the same time, like, this is all coming from your head, right? This is just communicating, which is absolutely amazing. So, once again, comrade, I want to thank you again for contributing here on this show.
Thanks a lot.
And bringing this here.
Always great to be here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're going to take a short break here. I'm back in the USSR, and we're going to be back after a few minutes. So please stay tuned. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. What I'm about to play for you right now is a recording, an excerpt from a video called American Revolution 2, and what it displays is probably one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. You know, and it's not as easy to get a full feel for it just listening to it. You know, it's better actually to watch it. But this is of a meeting between the Black Panther Party and the organization known as the Young Patriots. The Young Patriots were organizing in Chicago in the late 1960s. They were white working class people, mostly from the Appalachian region. You know, had high levels of poverty in their community. Were also victimized by police violence. A lot of the same problems that, you know, black people were facing in Chicago at that time as well. And so they formed an alliance. They joined together. They defied racism. They defied all the propaganda, the reactionary propaganda that white people normally are fed. and they stood together against police brutality, against police violence, against capitalism, really. And it's a really inspiring thing to listen to. So that's what I'm going to play for you right now. And this is the kind of stuff that we really need to see more of. I'm just going to leave it at that. So got to listen to this. This is the Black Panthers and the Young Lords. And the Young, say Young Lords. And the Young Patriots, let me say. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
This is poor people's power. And that's what this little hand-painted button's all about that we've been passing around to people. People that want to take over and have a government for themselves, that they'll be treated right. That's what it's all about. I want to introduce a man to come over tonight from another part of town, but he's fighting for some of the same causes we're fighting for, and start the meeting off. So I'm going to introduce you to Bob Lee here and let him rap a little while. Bob.
I'm a Black Panther. I'm a section leader of the Black Panther. This is Parson. He's a security man. This is Sister Ruby. We met with Junebug and his brothers last Wednesday night, last week, at the Church of Three Crosses, where we both had a chance to rally, get together. Panthers are here. Panthers are here. For Uptown.
Okay.
For anyone who lives in Uptown, be brown, green, yellow, purple, or pink. But I'm saying Panthers are here, and you'll have to tell us what we can do and what we can do together. We come here with our hearts open. You cast to supervise us where we can be of help to you.
One thing we're going to have to do is put our heads together and figure out where we can help Uptown, help the people in Uptown.
Right.
And the thing is that I want everybody who's got any questions at all to speak them up and say them now.
Who's here is concerned people? Who's here want to see this thing move?
Yeah, man.
Right on. Well, the first thing we talk about now is how we're going to organize. You know, where are we going to organize? We all must right now, man, figure out, like, what we want. You know, what do we want? What do you want? What do you want, man? What do you want in your community? What do you want here?
Look here, man.
Don't lay back on the cuts, man. And, you know, like, we're not moving, man. Are you afraid of the pain? You want to take the berets off, man, or what, man?
Do you propose that you do a lot of marching and things like
no,
that?
No, sir. No, sir.
Marching seems to do more harm than do good.
No, sir. No marching. No, sir. The thing that we're about is that this is your community. This is your community. Let's move.
Come on.
You know, and we can't move without you. We can't move. We can't move without the people.
Like on the west side and south side, you have a basic unity to start with.
Got before the skin color.
Right.
Okay, but damn, the same thing we got to deal with is concept of poverty, man. We got to get rid of the color thing, see? I mean, concept of the same thing, there's welfare up here, people on welfare up here, there's people that receive ABC,
right.
You know, there's police brutality up here, there's rats and roaches. There's poverty up here. That's the first thing that we can unite on. That's the common thing we have, man. And we can unite on poverty and unite on the concept of poverty. You know, everything becomes colors, man.
Right on.
The building's not fit for dogs to live in, but humans having to pay $144 a month for the thing. They sell the building, you know, to new ownership. What we need is understanding among the people.
Right on.
Coalition between the people to stick together.
Right on.
And take them owners. And put them over here in the lake somewhere.
Right on. Right on. This man right here. You know, the things he said, these are things we can start working on. We can start working on those very things. Getting rid of the Urban Progress Center. Get the cats gonna get themselves together. Get rid of these little junky employment agencies, the cats don't get. I mean, these are things you can start working from, man. These are things you can start working from. Ladies, stand up and tell us some of the hell you've been going through. I did something.
Show my granddaughter, Marcellus. She wants to be free.
Stand up.
Tell them what they're doing to Eddie out there. When we come out and how they talk to your mother and how they jumped on us down. Come on, don't be bashful. I talk too much. You all got to talk. Now's the time to talk.
You don't want your kid to be raised up the jive you're coming through now. You want it.
I can't tell.
Come on. You gotta do something. You can't have only one or two leaders.
No, please, stand up. Just stand up.
You gotta have the people doing something.
Can you do it?
Come on.
My sister-in-law, she came up and said that the cops were out there frisking my brother, and we went out there, and there was one of them cops were sticking a knife in my brother's behind, just sticking him. I went up and I asked him what he was doing. He said, it's none of your business. He told me to get out of there, asked me who I was, and I said I was his sister, and he told me to get the hell out of there.
Well, she was cussing the cops out like mad. She's a
call up the police, and when nothing's going on, and the police are going to come make it happen.
They're trying to put your words in your mouth, make you put yourself in jail.
But I want you people to stick together, and I'll stick with Black Panther, and they'll stick with me, and I know they will.
We're going to do it our own way, and that's all there is to it.
Right on, your own way.
I saw a Black Panther's movie last week. The points are real good, man. You got to pick up your gun, that's all.
Right on.
Oh, I'm tired of it. I'm tired of them coming down the street and kicking my damn head in for nothing I ain't done.
Bobby Hutton gave his life, man. The cat was 18 years old. He gave his life. And from that day on, Panthers moved up. Moved up for the Black community of concern. From that day on, Panthers moved up because Black communities knew and felt what Huey was saying. But Huey went out and did for the people what the people wanted to do for the last 15, 20 years. He did to the pig what Roger would like to do. Nobody's saying that. Hey, we're not saying go out and off the pig, go out and start shooting up pigs. You know, but this way Huey did it. If it comes to that, I'm sure that one of these brothers are capable of doing it.
We're going to stop this shit one way or the other if we have to fight with guns.
Before you can do that, got to be some discipline.
I'm reacting to what you say you want to do.
Okay. The first thing is discipline, man, before you can even control the pig, or you're off you. You're off you, man. From here, you start out going into the community so the community know, man, what you're doing. Because, see, if the pig off you, you'd be off you, Roger, and you'd be going to the funeral, man, you've been in the casket, and the people in the community don't even know you're dead. You got to have the community in the back. The pigs, the police are protecting the landlords. If Roger run out with a Molotov cocktail to throw in one of these rat-infested buildings, they kill him. Somebody answer why. Why the man come down on us like that? Why?
Protecting people, they're about protecting property.
Right. You been to jail for, baby? You been to jail? Right on. So I'll tell you nothing about the pig. Once you realize, man, that your house is funky with rats and roaches, you know, same way a black dude's house is, you know, once you realize that your brothers have been brutalized by the cops, the same way the west side and south side is, you know, once you realize, man, that you're getting inadequate, man, education in these high schools, the junior high schools over here, the same way the south side and the west side, you know, once you realize that you are paying taxes, right, taxes for the cops to whoop your ass, you're paying them. You're paying them, man, for to whoop your ass. You're paying them to come in to beat your children. You're paying them to run you off the corners. And you're paying them to kill you. And deal from there. The same things happen on the south side and the west side. And if you can realize that concept of poverty, the concept of poverty,
right,
a revolution can begin.
Now Wednesday, Model Cities is meeting. And they're going to put through some kind of program. And, you know, we're all going to get run out of here eventually. Now I put a proposal together to people that want to be together, people listening to this stuff and digging it, and people that's got it in their hearts that want to be together, be up here Wednesday. We go down and we stop that meeting.
All through the city, there's $38 million supposed to be split up to bring poor people out of poverty.
What the hell have they bought? What have they done? Not a damn thing.
These goddamn people that own businesses here in Uptown are sitting down and we can't sit on those consoles. We can't tell where the money ought to go. Damn it, we ought to go down there and stop them and piss on the money and do the neighborhood right.
Right, if we can't do it, they oughtn't to do it. Wednesday will be for confronting the model cities.
And you better be together because the pigs are in here right now
and they know what we gonna do, you dig? When you do it right, or don't do it at all.
We done something with trouble, sir.
Yeah, but ain't now no we're trouble, gonna get on the floor if we get over that.
Bob.
Look at you, sir.
I'll see you Monday night.
Look at you.
I'll see you Monday.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. What I'm going to play for you right now, what I'm going to really end the show off on, is one of the most inspiring speeches I think was that has been given in American history. This is Paul Robeson's defiant speech given to the House Committee on Un-American Activities in the 1950s, and shows you how Paul Robeson defied the McCarthyites. And the reactionary fascists in America, you know, and stood up for what he believed, you know, stood up for who he was as a black man, as a communist, and refused to back down, you know, practiced what he preached. It's powerful stuff. I'm going to close things on that. Please stay tuned.
Mr. Robeson. Do I have the privilege of asking who's addressing me?
I'm Richard Ahrens.
What is your position?
I'm director of the staff. Did you file a passport application in July 2, 1954?
I filed about 25 in the last few months.
In July of 1954, were you requested to submit a non-communist affidavit?
Under no conditions would I think of signing such an affidavit. It is a contradiction of the rights of American citizens.
Are you now a member of the Communist Party?
Oh, please, please, please.
Please answer, will you, Mr. Robeson?
What is the Communist Party? What do you mean by that?
Are you now a member of the Communist Party?
Would you like to come to the ballot box when I vote and take off the ballot and see?
Mr. Chairman, I respectfully suggest the witness be directed to answer the question.
You are directed to answer the question.
I invoke the Fifth Amendment and forget it.
I respectfully suggest the witness be directed to answer the question whether, if he gave us a truthful answer, he would be supplying information which might be used against him in a criminal proceeding.
You are directed to answer,
gentlemen,
Mr. Robeson.
In the first place, wherever I have been in the world, the first to die in the struggle against fascism were the communists. I laid many wreaths upon the graves of communists. That is not criminal. Chief Justice Warren has been very clear that the Fifth Amendment does not have anything to do with the inference of criminality, and I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Have you ever been known under the name of John Thomas?
Oh, please, does somebody here want me to put up for perjury someplace? John Thomas, my name is Paul Robeson, and anything I have to say, I have said in public all over the world, and that is why I'm here today.
Mr. Chairman, I ask that you direct the witness to answer the question he's making a speech.
I ask you to affirm or deny the fact that your Communist Party name was John Thomas.
I invoke the Fifth Amendment. This is really ridiculous.
The witness talks very loud when he makes a speech, but when he invokes the Fifth Amendment, I can't hear him.
I have medals for diction. Right. I can talk plenty loud.
Will you talk a little louder?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment loudly.
Sir, who are Mr. and Mrs. Vladimir
Nikiev? I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Do you know a Manning Johnson?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Do you know Gregory Kifetz?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Do you know a Max Juergen?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Max Juergen.
Why don't you have these people here to be cross-examined? Could I ask whether this is legal?
This is not only legal, but usual. By unanimous vote, this committee has been instructed to perform this very distasteful task.
To whom am I talking?
You're speaking to the chairman of the committee.
Mr. Walter?
Yes.
The Pennsylvania Walter?
That is right.
Representative of the steel workers?
That is right.
And the coal mining workers?
That is right.
Not United States Steel, by any chance. A great patriot.
That is right.
You are the author of the bills that are going to keep all kinds of decent people out of the country.
No, only your kind.
Colored people like myself. And you would let in the Teutonic Anglo-Saxon stock.
We are trying to make it easier to get rid of your kind, too.
You don't want any colored people to come in. Could I be allowed to read from my statement?
Will you just tell this committee, please, while under oath, Mr. Robeson, the communists who participated in the preparation of that statement?
Oh, please. The reason I'm here today from the mouth of the State Department itself is, I shall not be allowed to travel because I have struggled for the independence of the colonial peoples of Africa. The other reason I'm here today, again, from the State Department and from the record of the Court of Appeals, is that when I am abroad, I speak out against injustices against the Negro people in this land. That is why I'm here. I'm not being tried for whether I'm a communist. I'm being tried for fighting for the rights of my people, who are still second-class citizens in this country, in this United States of America. My mother was born in your state, and my mother was a Quaker. My ancestors, in the time of Washington, baked bread for George Washington's troops when they crossed the Delaware. My father was a slave. I stand here struggling for the rights of my people to be full citizens in this country. And we are not. We are not in Mississippi. We are not in Montgomery, Alabama. We are not in Washington. We are nowhere. And that is why I am here today. You want to shut up every Negro who has the courage to stand up and fight for the rights of his people, for the rights of workers. And I have been on many a picket line for the steel workers, too. And that is why I'm here today.
Would you tell us whether or not you know Thomas W. Young?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Thomas W. Young is a Negro president of the Guide Publishing Company. I'd like to read you his testimony, quote, Paul Robeson has no moral right to place in jeopardy the welfare of the American Negro to advance a foreign cause. In the eyes of the Negro people, this false prophet is unfaithful to their country, and they repudiate him, close quote. Do you know the man that said that?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment now. Can I read my statement? It is a sad and bitter comment.
While you were in Paris in 1949, Mr. Robeson, did you tell an audience the American Negro would never go to war against the Soviet government?
May I say that is slightly out of context. May I explain to you what I did say? I remember the speech very well. 2,000 students who came from populations that would range to 600 or 700 million people asked me to say in their name that they did not want war. No part of my speech in Paris says 15 million American Negroes would do anything. I said it was my feeling that the American people would struggle for peace, and that has been since underscored by the President of these United States. Now, in passing, I said...
Any people who want war?
Listen to me. I said it was unthinkable to me that any people could take up arms in the name of a man like Senator Eastland of Mississippi against anybody. Gentlemen, I still say that. This United States government should go to Mississippi and protect my people. That is what it should do.
I lay before you, sir, an article. Quote, I am looking for full freedom, unquote, by Paul Robeson in The Worker. July 3rd, 1949, quote, I said it was unthinkable that the Negro people of America or elsewhere could be drawn into war with the Soviet Union. I repeat it with a hundredfold emphasis, they will not, close quote.
And gentlemen, they have not. It is clear that no Americans are going to go to war with the Soviet Union.
While you were in Stockholm, did you make a little speech?
I made all kinds of speeches.
Let me read you a quotation.
Let me listen.
Do so, please.
I am a lawyer.
It would be a revelation if you would listen to counsel.
In good company, I usually listen. But you know, people wander around in such fancy places.
You said, Mr. Robeson, and I quote, I belong to the American resistance movement, which fights against American imperialism, just as the resistance movement fought against Hitler.
Just like Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman were underground railroaders and fighting for our freedom, you bet your life.
I have to insist that you listen to these questions.
I am listening.
I quote further, why should the Negroes ever fight against the only nation in the world where racial discrimination is prohibited and where the people can live freely? Never. They will never fight against either the Soviet Union or the people's democracies, close quote. Did you make that statement?
I do not remember, but what is perfectly clear today is that 900 million people, other colored people, have told you they will not. 400 million in India and millions everywhere have told you that.
The witness has answered the question. He doesn't need to make a speech.
Did you write an article that was published in the USSR Information Bulletin?
Yes.
Quote, I want to emphasize that only here in the Soviet Union did I feel that I was a real man with a capital M, close quote.
I would say, what is your name?
Arendt.
I am quite willing to answer the question. When I was a singer years ago, And this you will have to listen to.
I am listening.
I am a bass singer, and so for me, it was Chelyapin, the great Russian bass, not Caruso the tenor. I learned the Russian language to sing their songs. I wish you would listen now.
Mr. Chairman, I ask you to direct the witness to answer the question.
Just be fair with me.
I ask for order.
The great poet of Russia is of African blood.
Let us not go so far afield.
It is important to explain this.
Did you make that statement?
When I first went to Russia in 1934...
Did you make that statement?
When I first went to Russia in 1934...
Did you make that statement?
In Russia, I felt for the first time like a full human being. No color prejudice like in Mississippi. No color prejudice like in Washington. It was the first time I felt like a human being. Well, I do not feel the pressure of color as I feel it in this committee today.
Why do you not stay in Russia?
Because my father was a slave, and my people died to build this country. And I'm going to stay here and have a part of it just like you, and no fascist-minded people will drive me from it. Is that clear?
You are here because you are promoting the communist cause.
I am here because I'm opposing the neo-fascist cause, which I see arising in these committees. Jefferson could be sitting here, and Frederick Douglass could be sitting here. Eugene Debs could be sitting here.
Now, what prejudice are you talking about? You were graduated from Rutgers, and you were graduated from the University of Pennsylvania. I remember seeing you play football at Lehigh. There was no prejudice against you.
Just a moment. This is something I challenge very deeply, that the success of a few Negroes can make up for $700 a year for thousands of Negro families in the South. My father was a slave, and I have cousins who are sharecroppers. I do not see success in terms of myself. I have sacrificed hundreds of thousands of dollars for what I believe in.
While you were in Moscow, Mr. Robeson, did you make a speech lauding Stalin?
I can't remember.
Have you recently changed
your
mind about Stalin?
What has happened to Stalin, gentlemen, is a question for the Soviet Union, and I won't argue with a representative of the people who, in building America, wasted the lives of my people. You are responsible, you and your forebears, for 60 to 100 million black people dying in the slave ships and on the plantations. Mm-hmm. Don't you ask me about anybody.
Please. I'm sure you wouldn't want to discuss with us the slave labor camps in the
Nothing
Soviet
Union.
Nothing
could be built more on slavery than this society, I assure you.
I would invite your attention to the Daily Worker of June 29, 1949, with reference to a get-together with you and Ben Davis, formerly Communist Councilman in New York. Do you know Ben
One
Davis?
One of my dearest friends. He is as patriotic an American as can be. And you, gentlemen, are the non-patriots.
Just a minute.
You are the un-Americans.
The hearing is now adjourned.
I think it should be.
I've endured all of this that I can.
Can I read my statement?
No! The meeting is adjourned.
It should be.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Sharmini Peres coming to you from Baltimore. This week is the anniversary of the formation of the Black Panther Party. That was 1966, 48 years ago. The original six members of the Black Panther Party were, and they are depicted in this photograph, from the top left is Albert Big Man Howard, Huey P. Newton, the defense minister, Sherman Fort, Bobby Seale, the chairman, and in the bottom row is Reggie Fort, Little Bobby Hutton, the treasurer. To talk about all of this history with us today is the former Black Panther Party member in Baltimore, is Eddie Conway. Eddie Conway was a member of the Baltimore Black Panther Party who spent 44 years in prison for an alleged crime of killing a police officer, a crime that he did not commit. If you are curious, and you should be, watch the series that The Real News has with Eddie Conway on Reality Asserts Itself, or you can make a donation to The Real News and get a copy of his book, Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther. Thank you so much for joining us, Eddie.
I'm happy to be here.
Eddie, take us back in time and describe the conditions that the African Americans in this country were facing at the time the Black Panther Party was formed.
Well, I think the Black Panther Party grew out of the disappointment of the civil rights movement and its failure to make really significant changes. I think initially from like the early 50s on up to the mid 60s, in the South, there was a massive movement to segregate things. There to make the buses, the interstate highways, safe to travel on the buses for blacks and whites together. There was a number of bills and laws put in to get voting rights. And I think we thought in the black community that that would solve the problem of racism, that would solve the problem of police brutality, that would solve the problem of poverty, and that would solve the problem of a red line district in terms of us being forced to live in ghettos. After those bills were passed, after those minor victories were made, we found out that we still suffered the same conditions. Racism still existed. Poverty was still widespread through our community. We didn't have enough money, even though we had integrated lunch counters. We had had the right then to send our children to college. We couldn't afford to do that. We didn't have the jobs that would afford us the kind of payrolls, paychecks that would allow us to do that. The brutality continued every week in some city, and in most cities across the country, young black men were being killed or beaten to death by the police department. And as a result of all this, I think people decided that, well, they needed to organize a different way instead of nonviolent protests in order to change their conditions. And one of the things that they concluded, at least young people, is that if they were going to organize, they weren't going to allow themselves to be attacked by dogs or water hoses or be beaten in the street by police. So they decided to organize in a self-defensive manner.
Eddie, this was a time that the civil rights movement had actually made some gains, the ending of Jim Crow and racial segregation. And they did it through civil disobedience. They did it through peaceful means as far as the civil rights movement was concerned. It was known worldwide for being a fairly peaceful and nonviolent movement. However, the African American community that was so disenfranchised, especially in urban cities, felt the need to take up arms to defend themselves. And this was particularly because of the police brutality that they were experiencing. Tell us about that experience.
Well, it wasn't just, it was the police brutality, but it also involved attacks against people that were organized in a nonviolent manner. Churches were being bombed. Buses were being burned by unruly mobs. People were being attacked in the middle of the night and dumped in the rivers in Mississippi and in other places. So to organize, some of the key organizers were being assassinated on their front steps. So I think younger people that decided that they would take up the banner of continuing the fight to organize for social justice and human rights decided that if they wanted to organize, then they needed to organize in a way in which they could defend themselves. And so that a lot of organizations sprung up, but one of them was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense.
And that was taking up arms to defend themselves against police and, at the time, KKK brutalities that they were also experiencing.
Yes. And it was legal to do that because the laws in America said that everybody had a right to have weapons. And all the other organizations, the States' Rights Party, the Minutemen, the Nazis, the Ku Klux Klans, every organization was allowed to have weapons. And the individual citizens was riding around with weapons in the back of their truck on gun racks, you know. So the reaction to the Black Panther Party was strictly a racist reaction, and it didn't have anything to do with the legality of us being armed.
In addition to the racism, the situation for African Americans in urban cities were exasperated by the fact that the jobs that most of them had come to the city to acquire had actually by this time moved out of the cities and into the suburbs, along with white migration out of urban centers. And describe that for us, joblessness, you know, access to housing, and, you know, housing at the time was in substandard conditions when it came to African Americans. That added to this desire for a more militant resistance.
Yes, because they at that time it was something we call white flight. You know, black people were allowed to move in because of integration into other neighborhoods. The white residents in those neighborhoods fled to suburbia. A lot of federal money, a lot of government money was going to build up suburbia, the interstate highways and all the rest of that stuff. And consequently, jobs and factories moved out to those areas. And inner city people couldn't afford or could not get out there because of lack of transportation or because they were just not desirable as the workforce. So the community continued to be impoverished. It got more impoverished, and this created a lot of rage and frustration, which led to a lot of conflicts with the police and police brutality and ultimately riots. And so there was a period of from 65 to 70 where there were hundreds and hundreds of riots in all across America. Almost every major city had a major riot as a result of police brutality primarily, but as the real results of the poverty and the conditions that people were living in.
The levels of poverty you were just talking about were grave. Mm-hmm. And I don't think enough people today realize the dire poverty that African Americans were living in. I know some stories that I've heard, you know, people actually used to just have one meal a day because they couldn't afford it. Mm-hmm. And these are the conditions in which you were working and organizing the Black Panther Party here in Baltimore.
Yes, well, one of the things that we discovered early on was that children were going to school hungry. I mean, this was a national epidemic, and we decided to start free breakfast programs for children, and we had no idea it would be successful. We created those programs. We opened the door. Hundreds and thousands of children came every morning on their own accord to get something to eat because we learned that, you know, if you send children to school hungry, they don't learn anything. They're miserable most of the day, and then they're not going to be very attentive in terms of finding out stuff. And I think that was one of the really problems of poverty in our community. But the other problem, which was a major problem, was the lack of health care. The only way you got medical care in the black community during that period was that you had to have some sort of a traumatic event, a wound, or injury of
emergency,
and then you could go to the emergency. Other than that, there was no health insurance for the most of the population. There was no way to get medical care. There was no preventive health. So we organized health clinics in the cities and ambulance services. And also at that time, it was, even though it was just beginning the prison industrial complex, the prisons were located out in rural white communities, and most family members could not afford to get out there, catch buses, have transportation back and forth, or make those long trips and stay overnight in those what was then very racist kind of communities. So we created free bus services and stuff. So there was a number of things that were going on. So we created a food co-op, say, for instance, because people were running out of food 1 week before they got their food stamps or whatever. Yeah.
So the socialization that took place, I mean, the Black Panther Party is, of course, known for their militancy and taking up arms in order to defend themselves, but there was also a socialization that was taking place through the breakfast programs, and the politics were getting more radical and different than the civil rights movement. And take us through that path of the difference between the politics of the civil rights movement and the politics of the Black Panthers?
Well, the politics of the civil rights movement was pretty much we wanted a piece of the pie, we wanted to live the American dream, we wanted to have a black capitalist society. The Black Panther Party started off at the very beginning and said that this economic social arrangement wasn't working for the majority of poor people in the community, and we needed to organize around collective kind of economics, or organize where we could talk about economic democracy, and we could share the wealth of the community. And we did story after story in the Black Panther Party paper about that. But what we found out was that in our community, people learn from example. So we organized the resources in the community to feed the children. We showed how you could take the things that was available to us, we could harness those resources and then direct them to solving a problem. And it was socialism by example. And so even though people could read and understand those ideas, they could actually live and see those ideas when they realized that they could collectively pool their resources, get a mass amount of stuff, and then sell it very cheap and undercut the capitalist merchants, say, for instance. And that idea transferred itself into other communities, and I think that's what made the Black Panther Party a pariah for the government, is that the American Indian movement took up those ideas and principles. The Latino group, the Brown Berets, they took up that idea. The White Panther Party sprung up, took up that idea. The Young Lords, the Puerto Ricans, they took up that idea. The Asian revolutionary groups, they took up that idea. And the Black Panther Party ideas of collective socialism and so on spread to India, so they end up with a New Delhi Panthers. It spread to Australia, they end up with Australian Panthers, New Zealand Panthers, Israeli Panthers of all things. The Panther Party sprung up in Africa, it sprung up in Europe, and this became a problem for the American government because those ideas were rapidly traveling around the globe, but they were also saying that the richest country in the world had a real problem of poverty in large segments of its population, white and black, and that it wasn't a racist issue, it was really an economic issue.
Let's fast forward to today. Mm-hmm. I mean, the conditions that African Americans were facing at that time, and you look at examples of Ferguson, mm-hmm. Philadelphia, Baltimore, mm-hmm. New Orleans, and the list goes on. But some of the conditions that you were facing at that time is still present. You got out of prison 44 years later, the conditions seems to be more or less similar, with perhaps a few gains. What now for the young people that are organizing and you know, working, trying to dismantle this horrid, you know, conditions, segregated conditions in large parts of Baltimore? What do you have to say to them?
Well, one, I'm going to disagree about the conditions being similar. No, the conditions are worse. There is a segment of our population, and I'm talking the black population right now, there's a segment of our population that has, quote unquote, arrived. You know, the P. Diddy's, the Oprah's, the Bill Cosby's, the Jay-Z's or Beyonce's, et cetera, entertainers pretty much or whatever. But for the most part, most of our population is impoverished, unemployed, suffering from drug epidemics. Even those that are working and are working for large places like Walmart or Target and whatnot, they are receiving food stamps. They need food stamps to augment their salaries. So even those hard-working people that work 40 hours a week still can't afford to live in America. So the conditions are far worse. And I think the brutality in Ferguson or Cincinnati or in New York or in Oakland, and it's case after case after case in Houston, in Baltimore, has gotten completely out of control. And I think young people today probably need to go back to the basics. They need to organize in their community in ways in which they can create food security. They need to create their own particular jobs. They need to start talking about community control of the police. They need to make a determination of what they can do to gain control of the housing stock, the unused land, etc. But most of all, probably, and I don't know how successful we'll be with this, but they need to develop schools and academies or even reading or study groups where they can start studying history and studying what's going on and come up with some solutions of what to do.
Also the community control of the media. This is why you're at the Real News.
Yes, 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 because obviously the 85% of the media now in America is owned by six multinational corporations that certainly don't have the interests of people down on the ground, poor people in particular, at heart. They work in the interests of an elite. And most of the key reporters and stars of those things, they're millionaires themselves. And so they certainly are not going to report the news from the ground. And I think that's what the Real News does anyway.
Eddie, thank you so much for joining us.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
And thank you for joining us on the Real News Network.
Welcome to The Real News. I'm Eddie Conway from Baltimore. I was joined in the studio by Ward Churchill, co-author of the COINTELPRO papers. Churchill is an author, an activist, and a professor, and he has done a lot of scholarly work around COINTELPRO. One of his other books is Agents of Repression, which is a detailed study of government agents' attacks on the 1960s social movement. So can you give me kind of like a short overview of what COINTELPRO was?
Well, for starters, COINTELPRO, the word, the term, it's an acronym, cryptonym, because the program was secret for as long as it existed in a formal sense, stands for Counterintelligence Program, CO. Okay, from the counter, intel, pretty intelligence, and program, COINTELPRO. It was a secret program because it was an illegal program. Simplest terms, it was to take the methods and techniques that were used by the FBI to neutralize the activities of intelligence operatives of hostile foreign powers inside the United States, primarily the KGB, but you know, in principle at least, any hostile foreign power. Intelligence operatives of a hostile foreign power are not covered by constitutional rights, and arguably, in the view of the FBI, weren't even covered by human rights, and maybe that's the rules of the game in that sector. But COINTELPRO was to take these techniques and use them against select groups of American citizens, those who were considered to be politically objectionable in the mind of the FBI. All right. The program was initiated, its incept date, as they put it, was in August of 1956, and the original target was the American Communist Party, CPUSA, as they called it. And it eventually included Socialist Workers' Party, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, the Black Liberation Movement. There's overlap between the Socialist Workers' Party program, the targeting program, and the Black Liberation Movement insofar as they targeted the Civil Rights Movement in the South during the early 60s. But primarily, the Black Liberation Movement stuff was aimed at the later phase of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Republic of New Africa, and particularly the Black Panther Party. You also had a COINTELPRO that was aimed at the so-called New Left, primarily Students for a Democratic Society and its offshoots. And you had various programs that never were developed as full-fledged operational entities that targeted the anti-war movement in its non-leftist configuration, so the Catholic protest movement, for example, Every Mother for Peace. A number of universities, insofar as they had programs that were considered to be feeders, indoctrination, or whatever, with regard to the various movements that were targeted, women's liberation movement to a certain extent. It was discovered in 1971, and that's the formal end date. It didn't actually begin in 56, and it didn't actually end in 71, but that's the formal parameters when they actually used that cryptonym, COINTELPRO.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me, what did